Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
You know, Hub, I think you hit a great point there.
Hub Arkish.
The Arkish family in pro football media journalism has been around almost as long as the game itself.
670 The Score's NFL Insider.
I think the Packers have got problems on defense. I think they've got, you know, two great pass rushers. But other than that, it's not an impressive unit.
Shaw Media and Pro Football Weekly.
I have a lot of Packer friends up in Wisconsin, unfortunately. And they're all bragging, saying that this tight end that the Packers got is going to be a way better prospect than the ones that the Bears got, this guy that they got from Notre Dame.
So, Mike, you want to comment on the fact that your Packer friends know more about the draft than Ryan Pace? Who cares? Yeah, but my buddy said so. Ryan Pace must be nuts.
Hub Arkish, isn't that getting better than this?
Hub Arkish with McNeil and Parkins on 670 The Score.
Where this segment is brought to you by Lynn Home Roofing. We talk to Hub Arkish every Tuesday at 4 o'clock on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford is in Melrose Park. Hub, how you doing today?
I am good. How are you guys?
Good. Always good to talk football with you, Hub, whether it's past or present. Not a ton of present. NFL teams, some of them, many of them, opening their facilities today for skeleton crews. No coaches or players allowed unless the players are rehabbing injuries. What are the next events, to your knowledge, with the boys up at Halas Hall? What are going to be the first few guys who come in to start rehabbing those injuries, off-season surgeries, et cetera?
Well, Mac, I don't know who's in town at this point, and if they've been rehabbing locally, wherever they've been sheltering or whatever, I'm not sure there's going to be a rush to get here. Obviously, you've got Mitch Trubisky coming off the off-season shoulder surgery. I'm trying off the top of my head to think of other guys who had surgeries during the off-season. Possibly, you know, Roquan Smith, Danny Trevathan. But, you know, there's no clarity on whether they're actually in Chicago right now or in their homes away from homes or their permanent homes, whatever we call them. So the next steps is what this is all about is this is basically open for the business side of the operations. As you said, no coaches or players are allowed in the building yet. So they're trying to begin to prepare for when they do bring people back. What will be happening is that they're doing this virtual off-season workout program, which if you think about it, is not really a workout program because they're not, you know, literally pushing weights in front of their computers. But they will be moving to their scheduled OTAs beginning next week and for the next 3 weeks, and then there will be a mini camp. At this point, that's all virtual. So what'll happen is that they'll be doing a lot of playbook work, a lot of, you know, lifestyle type stuff, all in Zoom meetings, meeting their new coaches. We as media will have Zoom visits with a number of the veteran players for the first time, which I know everybody is anxious for. We will speak to Mitch Trubisky for the first time since the season ended in the next couple of weeks. So, you know, that should be revealing for fans. But for the most part, they're like the rest of us, guys. They're waiting until we figure out when we can actually all work in the same place to be able to do anything resembling any kind of football activities.
When you see the images come out of Tom Brady working out with quarterbacks and his center and his new receivers in Tampa, and, you know, there's been footage of Ben Roethlisberger and some of his receivers, and there's various things like that going around the league. Is there a belief that the players are actually adhering to social distancing, or is this just a wink, wink, nod, nod, you can't do it at the facility, but go find a field and work out?
You know, Danny, I guess I can only believe my eyes. And when we see some of this stuff leak out, you can run patterns and throw to each other from 6 feet apart. But my gut tells me they're probably not being as careful as some, you know, think they should. I haven't seen any of this video link with any of them leak. I should say, with any of them wearing masks. I don't know that Mitch Trubisky isn't throwing to Bears receivers or that Nick Foles isn't. My guess is that, you know, they're kind of like the rest of us. Some of us are taking this, you know, super seriously. Some of us are being as careful as we can, and others, you know, aren't buying the science. And so I think that, you know, one thing about football players that they don't get credit for, as a group, they do tend to be a little brighter than most other professional athletes, because most of them have had more extended education. Most of them have had to go to college, even for whatever that may be like, for some of the football programs who, you know, don't have the same restrictions and rules and requirements that non-athletic students do. A lot of these guys are fairly bright. And so I believe that the majority of them are following the science, as much as I know that all of them are not.
Yeah, and you got, you know, not everybody with a guaranteed contract. Also, short shelf life as an NFL player. Get your ass to work has been the MO, I guess, for most, as it probably should be. Hub, I'm going to bounce around here on a handful of topics. Have you read the collective bargaining agreement yet, start to finish?
No, I've waded into pieces of it, but okay. It's 300 and some pages, and it's
right.
not entertaining reading.
Probably not. There's a handful of things. I need some, and I should have texted you this earlier than just celebrating Pete Townsend's 75th birthday today. We'll do that too. But what I don't know is what I'd love to see the final language and offer some clarity on what the league, what the players agreed to regarding positive weed testing. Because we saw what the proposal was very late in the game, and it's kind of like slap on the wrist and second time offense. Parkins, help me remember this. We were in Arizona at the time. I think the second offense, you can play but at a reduced rate. They essentially
would fine you but no longer suspend you. And so you can't get suspended and miss time for positive recreational drug tests, but they still are going to do recreational drug tests. And I would just say, why would you play? Like, how is that better for the players? Like, they get to play in games and accrue stats but get worried about injury and not play? Like, it's not performance enhancing. They shouldn't be testing for it in the first place.
Well, guys, what I know for sure is that no player is going to be suspended for using marijuana, period. That's the agreement they ended up with. Part of the problem that management and the owners have is that in I don't know, I haven't done a survey, but in a lot of the states in the league, it's legal. And so how do you suspend an employee for a legal activity? You know, you're opening a can of worms there that you just don't want to deal with. So the new CBA eliminates suspensions for the use of marijuana, but how much guys can be fined, if they're going to be allowed to play, you're not going to want to keep them from practice or being around the facility. So I think what the owners had to agree to is that if they're going to insist, they can fine them, but that's about all they can do.
Such an odd thing. I don't know why the players would have agreed to that. I suppose it's a step in the right direction with the suspensions, but if the financial component, if they can still fine you your game check, I don't know why you would be playing for free.
The league didn't fully commit to their stupidity.
Yeah, but guys, if I can add here, I have no idea why any player agreed to this CBA, period. They got manhandled again, you know, and this time they did it a year sooner than they had to. So I actually do know, you know, the kind of, what do I want to say, the geography behind it, not geography, but the reality behind it, which is why players think the way they do with shortened careers and shortened, you know, earning power. But but it's a bad deal for the players. It's that simple. And there's stuff in there that's a lot worse than still possibly being fined for using marijuana.
What was the worst part of it to you?
The money they gave back. I mean, it's stunning to me. What's different, actually, you know, I suppose in a sense our industry isn't that different, because at the end of the day in the radio business, without guys talking on the air, you don't have a business. And so obviously you can't give all of the revenue to the guys talking on the air, but they are entitled to a disproportionate, you know, share of it. And you look at the game of football, the industry doesn't exist without the players. I mean, you know, and the owners are getting the lion's share of the profits. And it just, it doesn't make sense to me. And in a situation where you had a strong union that was willing to shut it down and take some pain, eventually the owners would have to give them more than 47 or 48% of the gross or the revenue, you know, the total football revenue, whatever you want to call it. And why they would agree to a new agreement for 10 more years that still leaves them somewhere between 4 and 6 percentage points lower in their share of the revenue than they got 10 years ago, it doesn't make sense to me. I shouldn't say it doesn't make sense. I get why they did it. I just think it's wrong.
Bob, I want to ask you a little bit about Michael McCaskey for a few minutes. Read with interest your column on it, retweeted it. We talked about it yesterday. There's fact, there's fiction, and there's a lot of gray areas with some people. And as you pointed out, it's a complicated thing to put into words what Mike McCaskey's leadership was for the Bears. If someone suggested to you he was a cheap owner, what is your response to that?
That relative to his operation of the football team, they're wrong. Michael was frugal. And, I mean, there are stories, some worth sharing and some worth not sharing, where, you know, he did things in the operation of the business that may have been penny wise and dollar foolish. Mm-hmm. But when it came to the football product, the facts are plain. They were not cheap. They've always been in the top third of teams, you know, relative to their commitments against the cap and what they've paid players. And basically, you know, Michael, because he was kind of frugal in other areas, because he didn't always present himself to the public in the best possible light, and because of what he inherited from his grandfather, and because he let Wilbur Marshall get away, which, by the way, to this day was not necessarily a bad decision if you look at what happened. You know, one thing about looking back in history is at least we know what happened afterwards. And so the reality is they got two first-round draft choices that turned into be very good football players, and Wilbur Marshall never made as big an impact in Washington or Arizona as he did in Chicago. So the idea that he was cheap because he let him get away, that's not football smart. But no, I don't think that – I think that the whole – shtick about the Bears being cheap is it just the facts say, tell you differently.
I think it's overrated as well. The thing with Marshall too was there was the spillover that had in the locker room. I mean, a lot of guys were upset by the message it created. I just looked to other organizations that were much quicker to act on stadium renovations than the Bears, and that clunky relationship with the Park District the Bears have had for years, I think, is on the list of Mike's negatives. Handful of other things that they were late to. Getting Hallis Hall redone. I mean, they didn't have the bubble until 97. There were other teams in the division who had cozy confines that were modernized well before the Bears, and that can't be on anybody other than Mike, can it?
No, you're right. But, Mac, this is where it complicated is the word because, you know, first of all, as far as Wilbur Marshall, I think we can't really discuss it in today's context of free agency and where the league is at, because there was no free agency then.
Right.
And it wasn't until 93 that you actually had, you know, meaningful movement of players. And this was, what, 5 years before that. So it's a tough subject to put in today's terms. But the things that you just addressed specifically, you're right. They were late in getting the stadium. Michael takes responsibility, but the reason it took so long to get Soldier Field rebuilt is because of Michael's personality quirks and Richie Daly's personality quirks. Neither one was going to let the other one have a new building. I mean, right. they just weren't going to agree. And then you get to Hallis Hall. You're right. They were late getting to it. But when he built it in 97, at that time, it was the best facility in the NFL. And now, even though he is gone and hasn't been part of the operation, with what they've completed in the last 2 years, it is once again the best facility in the NFL, or at least will be until the new stuff in Los Angeles opens. You know, people can argue about what Jones built in Dallas, but you look at what they've got in Dallas and what the Bears have here, and relative to what this facility does for players, coaches, and football operation, it's every bit as good or better. So, you know, a lot of what you get with Michael McCaskey is that he was such a quirky personality and such a different guy, and really never a guy you would associate with running an NFL team because of the way he carried himself. You know, sometimes he got a bad rap. Sometimes he deserved the criticism he got.
I thought a nice man, approachable, kind, never salty with anybody. I thought, you know, when I first heard Tom Ricketts speak, I thought, my God, he sounds like Michael McCaskey used to when he was standing at the lectern. That's that Ivy League polish, just miscast as a football man.
You know, it's funny you say that, because when I see Ricketts, the first thing I think of is McCaskey. To me, they sound a little bit alike. They talk the same way. Obviously, they come from very different places. Michael, listen, and I want to establish my bias. He became a friend once he resigned the chairmanship, and even during all the years that he was working, I always liked him. You know, he was always nice to me. Nobody had a closer look. I mean, you remember the days when I was public enemy number one at the Score, because I was doing those broadcasts with him, the management report at GN, when we moved over to MAQ. And I can tell you for a fact, he never approached anything with any bad intent towards anybody. He really loved the Bears and wanted to do the right thing as much or more than anybody. He just didn't always get it right. And it always bothered me that he was vilified so badly as he was, because he wasn't evil. You know, he didn't deserve that. He did deserve the criticism for a lot of the decision to fire Jerry Vannesi. Jerry wasn't a great GM. He wasn't really a GM. He was kind of hitting title only because he was Mike Ditka's best friend. Great guy, you know, and an outstanding, you know, executive. But from a football perspective, it wasn't the worst decision in the world. The problem was that Michael did it most likely to assuage his own ego and to take away Ditka's best friend. And the reason he didn't put somebody else in the job for over 10 years is because it made himself the de facto GM without having to take any responsibility for it. And it was the reason that the team suffered so badly in the 90s. And so, you know, there's a lot of stuff football-wise that you can criticize him for, but people who criticize him as a human being, I'll never understand that, because he was a good man.
Yo-yos.
They would be yo-yos, because Mac was, you know, kind of giving me all of the backstory and filling in some blanks for me yesterday, and he said in his career in Chicago media, he was one of the four most disliked figures in Chicago sports.
I think I haven't thought about this. I would agree right off the top of my head. I'm hard pressed to think of the other three. I mean, Jerry Krause, obviously.
Jerry Krause, Bill Wirtz.
Yeah.
And again, a nice guy, just people didn't like the way he ran his business.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Wirtz, at the end of the day, it was really just one thing. It was refusing to put the team on television, you know.
More than anything.
I mean, he had some good teams. You know, they never got it done all the way, but it was pretty much all based on just the unwillingness to let us see home games. You know, I think you guys talked about this. I don't know if you did yesterday or not. I haven't watched it. My treat tonight is episodes 9 and 10. But I read with great interest the unpublished Krause memoir that they had at NBC Chicago. And I think we had a piece at our website, something like it. And clearly Jerry Krause, you know, is on the list, and he was a tool. But when you actually get the facts behind the breakup of the team, there's a lot of good sports logic in it, you know. So these guys just, you know, the way, I mean, the piece about Phil allegedly telling Reinsdorf he wanted to bury the hatchet and Krause saying no, it makes him indefensible, even though he probably wasn't totally responsible for breaking up the dynasty.
We're talking to Hub Arkish, McNeil and Parkins on the Score. What was the most interesting or noteworthy thing that Matt Nagy said to the media or with his interviews last week?
Wow, Danny. You know, I have maintained all along, and nobody wants to hear it, that the Bears continue to be all in on Mitch Trubisky and prepared for the worst, but they're doing their best to still try and achieve a positive or a strong outcome. And, I mean, we talked, we being the media, not just he and I, for what I think it ended up running about 31 minutes on Friday, and it continued to be everything about, you know, making him the player he can be, being a better player, providing the backing, providing the competition. And I came away with nothing to change my mind. A lot of people think that they're just doing this to pave the way out of town, and Nick Foles is the guy. And I didn't hear him say anything to suggest that that is the case. Other than that, it's really a lot of conversation about trying to make the most out of all this virtual Zooming that they're doing. And I think it's a good thing, and I think there will be benefits to it. But I find it a little disingenuous to suggest that it's going to do anything to make them necessarily a better team on the field. It should improve, you know, the understanding of the system, the understanding of the playbook. But they've always done that work. It's the ability to translate that to the field when you're playing the game at full speed that matters. And I'm not sure, you know, how much benefit there is in all that. But they've got the handcuffs that we all have on, and they're doing the best they can in the circumstances. And it was, I did find it interesting to hear the way he described it and some of the parts of it that he is most focused on and believes are most beneficial.
Hub, score stories time from the rock and roll file. Born in 61, too young, really, had a very short window to see Keith Moon. I didn't see The Who until way too late in life. Young Hub Arkish got a chance to see Pete Townsend. He's celebrating a birthday today. He's 75 with Mooney. Take me to wherever it was, the amphitheater or the stadium. You had more than one or two nights with The Who, I believe your favorite band. So share a story from your hippie days.
I saw them live in the Auditorium Theater twice. And I want to say it was 70 and 72. I'm going to be off by a year or two possibly. But in 70 and 72, I would have been, 17 and 19. And they were my favorite band at the time. And they were really the first of, I believe, and I could be wrong about this, but I think they were the first ones to start setting their equipment on fire and breaking it up on stage. And that wasn't the best part of the show because it came at the end, but it was mind-boggling to a teenager to see these guys out there doing that in this, you know, temple of performance in the city of Chicago. And for our listeners and who have not had the pure joy of hearing any concert in the auditorium, I don't know if I've ever been in a concert venue that has better acoustics and sound. And you know, this was in a time when we had stereo. You know, we didn't have all of the electronics that we have now to give you the sound quality that you get. And it was the show. Some of it was the lyrics. It was also, I mean, the idea of a rock opera. I forget what year Tommy was, but whatever. The second time I saw him was a year after Tommy came out. So whatever year that was. And they were kind of changing music, you know, in a way that the Beatles had, and everybody else was later in coming to it. And then Pete Townsend, Moon was an incredible drummer. John Entwistle, a lot of people think is, you know, the best bass player ever. Townsend's the interesting character because in those days he was writing it all, and he had that signature move, the 360 arm swing on the chords. Yeah. Other than that, I think he was a bit overrated as a lead guitarist. You go back and listen to a lot of the Who stuff and. Yeah, it's great music, but he was certainly never in a Keith Richards, Eric Clapton type class. But they were just a great band, and it's unfortunate now. We all get old, you know. And when they came through last time, my kids wanted to get me tickets as a Christmas present, whatever it was. I said, guys, I don't want to see half the Who because the better half is gone. It was really Entwistle and Moon that made them special.
Yeah, I had a feeling you'd say that today. And I reconnected with a buddy last week. Social distancing responsible, but we had to have a few Pabst Blue Ribbons and maybe a little Mother Nature and listen to Quadrophenia start to finish, just hanging out in his garage. Still works for me, still gets it done. And you were there on the ground floor practically. Good for you, man. Well, that's a good thing about being old, Hub. You've seen a lot.
There's benefits, yeah. They're diminishing at this point, but there are benefits. But I'll tell you what, guys. Quadrophenia, Tommy was just so groundbreaking and such a breakthrough thing that Quadrophenia never, I think, was able to match it because, you know, it's the sequel and it's hard to do. And they didn't have the story, you know, that they had in Tommy. But go back, guys, go back and listen to Tommy from start to finish, because there's a whole story there and it still works today. And I find the music very entertaining. So, you know, that's why I love the band.
Awesome. Very
Hub, thank you very much as always. Great stuff. Stay safe. We'll talk to you next week.
Take care, guys.
Thanks, Hub.
That's Hub Arkish on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Matt Abaticola will tell Dan Bernstein stories for Bernsey's 25th anniversary coming up in 20 minutes. But a question that comes into sports, but a lot of parents are going to be having to answer this question themselves. I want to pose it to you, Mac, because it's all over the news. So we'll weigh in on it next.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Score.
I've been saying now for probably 3 weeks, I don't think we're going to have football in the fall. And I say that wanting college football to come back, but I'm basing that on what I think will happen. And I just don't see these major universities. I don't see the presidents of these major universities saying in August, you know what, all of you 30, 40, 50,000 students from all over the world, it's now safe to come back on campus and take your fall classes.
That's Brett McMurphy from the Paul Feinbaum Show a few weeks ago. And this story has been wild to follow, Mac. And we'll talk to Matt Abaticola about Dan Bernstein, 25 years at the Score, in 10 minutes. I was saying at the beginning, college football will be the toughest thing to come back, and college sports in general, because it's going to be impossible to make the argument that student athletes can play college athletics when the other students, it's not safe to go back on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And for the last few weeks, guys like Brett McMurphy and other reporters have been like, that's no longer how the administrators and the coaches are putting this, that like if they have to do online only classes, they're going to do anything they can to get football going for the revenue. And then just the other day, yesterday, Notre Dame's president says they plan to open up campus in the fall. They're going to open it up 2 weeks early, and some other schools are planning to open up early to try to get in the fall semester. And it looks like they're going to try to have college football, maybe without fans, maybe without any other fall sports, in some places maybe without kids on campus, just to get that money, which I can't believe it, but that's where we are right now, it looks like.
Oh, yeah. That's how I read it, and college football earns all the skepticism it receives. All of college athletics do, frankly, the way the NCAA has gone about its business for decades. Every reason to be suspicious that it's the almighty dollar. That's a lot of money from NBC that Notre Dame would be forfeiting. And it's natural to think, yeah, that's what the motivation is. I guess I was surprised a little bit yesterday to see Notre Dame make that announcement, August 10th, come on back. I had heard as recently as 4 weeks, 3 weeks ago, Ivy League school presidents were convening electronically to determine whether they were just going to punt the entire year. And there's been a shift in thinking. And something, I don't know if you want to get into this right now or save it for later on, because it's a meaty topic, is there is a growing feeling, you've expressed it, I don't know if you have on the show, but we're kind of looking, it's starting to feel like we're all going to be a part of a tremendous experiment very soon, aren't we? We're going to be playing Russian roulette with a deadly virus. We're gonna all mix back together sooner than what many experts believe is the right thing to do and see what happens. We're going to be the test group as a nation. 320 million of us, I believe, live in America. And everybody's so hungry to get back to work. And I understand financial stress is an incredible motivator. You got to feed your family. You got to pay your bills. You got to stay alive. I get that. It's a tough decision. Universities are financially dependent on the money they receive from those, especially the football factories like Notre Dame with its own deal with NBC. That's huge. So they earn their suspicions. You asked the question, what would you do as a parent? For me, I let my 18 or 19-year-old student son make or daughter make his or her decision. It's just my philosophy. It doesn't make me right. When my kids grew to majority age, I let them decide where they wanted to go to school, what they wanted to study, and I would be supportive whether they wanted to go to college or not. So I would leave that in their hands. That's their decision.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can make an argument that if you are financially supporting the college, that you have an influence on it in terms of whether or not to allow it. But I hear you. They're of majority age, right? If they can join the Army, they should be able to make that decision. And if you say if campus is going to be open, it's going to be hard not to send your kid to that campus. So it's a tough spot to be in. And it is seemingly going to be this big experiment, and obviously everybody is hoping for the best. And yeah, it's a little concerning how financially motivated it seems to be when we've got doctors saying that there is going to be a second wave of this thing, and we'll see how it goes, you know, which is just interesting to even say, like, we'll see how it goes with this really contagious, really serious disease. But we had Dr. Sitchenberg on last week, and he said, in football, if you had someone playing in a game with the virus, that there would be a high degree of likelihood that the majority of players on the field with that person would get the virus. Because you're in such close quarters, you're breathing on each other, so you breathe on one guy, then he breathes on another, then he breathes on another, and then you're on the pile and the tackle, and then you go for the ball, and then everyone's breathing on each other. Like that. By the end of it, it would spread that quickly. So,
yeah, it's not just on the field; it's in the locker rooms, it's on the bus, it's in the meeting rooms. You can't stop. You can't not be around each other doing that. You can't.
Yeah, it's just so it's just wild to see. Like, okay, like that's a doctor. These are university presidents. There's an athletic director, and here we go. Like, we're gonna see sports, and I want to see sports. I want to see safe sports. But college football, I was wrong. I thought it was going to be very, very difficult for that sport to come back. But it looks like it might be the easiest. And Dan Wolkin wrote a piece today at USA Today saying that this is the time for college athletes to unionize, because it is wild to see a sport that makes – I mean, don't make no mistake, it's professional sports, right? The television revenue for college football is way bigger than it is for, like, the National Hockey League, right? And that's professional hockey, and this is amateur football. But college football dwarfs it. It is a billion-dollar business, billions of dollars. And all of these people that have all of this financial incentive are making these decisions, and the players who will be risking their health have no seat at the table. Yeah. So it seems fundamentally unfair to me, but that's amateurism, I guess. Right? And they don't, I'm sure they want to play. But at some point, you want to have some sort of thing to maybe protect them from themselves a little bit. And so Dan Wolkin made the case that this was the time to unionize. I always thought that'd be much more likely in college basketball than college football. We saw the Northwestern attempt back in 2014, but it looks like we're about to get college football, which for fans is awesome. And I hope it's safe for the students involved. We thought we could have put on Dan Bernstein to celebrate 25 years at one station.
Nope.
But we just had him on, and you know, we would just be like laying bouquets at his feet. We love Dan so much. So we wanted to have someone who has, love, hate, whatever you want to call it, relationship with Bernsey. Matt Abaticola, his longtime producer, will tell stories of Dan Bernstein or roast him for his 25th anniversary next on The Score.
Well, if Abaticola said it, it's got to be true.
All right, fine, jerk. Hey, you want to put me on hold now? And then badmouth me? Idiot?
Yeah.
Exactly. I'll put you on hold. Turn your mic off. I'll say something, idiot. Exactly. Boom. Ranji, update time.
On Dan Bernstein's 25th anniversary at The Score, a tremendous accomplishment, we didn't want to just praise the man. We wanted to talk to someone who has a very singular, unique relationship with him. The man who produced Dan Bernstein's show longer than anyone. Longtime B&B producer, a Score guy forever, Matt Abaticola with us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford is in Melrose Park. What's up, Matty?
Hey, guys. How we doing today?
Matty, outstanding. It's great to hear your voice. I think of
you
regularly.
Well, it's great to be heard.
Yes, I imagine it is. Good to welcome on board. How you feeling, man?
I'm feeling good. And, Mac, I think about you a lot. And, you know, I just recently texted you. You know, I'm hoping for that dinner date so I can leave a piece of clothing in your car.
That was what you did. I believe it was an ascot. We
certainly
had
was.
Dinner because I was told by Terry Bors, you were producing Bors and Bernstein, that you got to meet Matt Abaticola. He's going to be your next partner. When you lose Yurko and Harry, Abaticola would be great. So I was curious, based on Terry's description of that. It aggravated a guy or two at my place up the dial, and it's my understanding it aggravated a few people at The Score, too, that we were together dining.
Well, it certainly did aggravate the man we're here to honor today at his 25th
really?
Anniversary. Oh,
did
yeah.
It?
Don't you remember? I told you that. We originally met down in Miami for the Super Bowl while we were working for, you know, different stations, obviously. And I, you know, met you initially through Terry and, you know, we hung out and, you know, we had a quick connection. And then when we came back into town, you and I grabbed dinner one night and I left my scarf in the back of your truck. And then I don't know how Dan heard about it, but he called me and he was mad that I was hanging out with the enemy, so he got a little bothered by it. But anyway, you know, I kind of thought it was cute. I thought it was cute that he was upset by it. But I was just like, you know, we're just starting a new man romance, and that's all we're doing. We're having dinner. It's not a big deal. So just relax about it.
I don't think he'd get mad today. Similar circumstance. Do you?
Well, no, I don't work there anymore.
Well, no, I mean not with you and me, but similar scenario. I think the Dan Bernstein looks at 50, Bernsey, is different than that guy from 06-ish when we first met.
No, yeah. I don't think. If there was a newer producer or someone on his show that hasn't been around for a while that you somehow had a connection with and went and had dinner, I don't think it would bother him. I mean, I don't know if he thought we were trading, you know, secrets, like there was stuff that we knew about radio that you didn't. When I was trying to get stuff out of you about radio that we didn't know. I mean, we were doing sports talk radio like it was something important to begin with. But it was pretty funny. But I think right now it wouldn't bother him at all. I can't believe it's been 25 years. That's insane.
Well, so when you hear that, like, it's a crazy accomplishment in this ridiculous business. But what do you think, like, why has he been able to do it for 25 years?
Well, I've always said this about Bernstein, Danny, and it's, that I truly believe he's one of the best at doing this job within the entire country. I've always felt, you know, that, you know, Dan and I, a lot of our conflict, like the real conflict that was ever generated, was all because of me basically responding to him being a turd. But I think I had higher expectations for Dan and what I thought he could do, you know, with his own career, and Dan never had the same lofty expectations that I had. And it was completely unfair for me to want him to do something that he didn't want to do. You know, he grew up in Chicago. He's a Chicago guy, or, you know, grew up in Deerfield. And to work here at The Score was like a dream gig for him. And, you know, why wouldn't it be? You know, working 4 or 5 hours a day doing sports talk in your hometown is an ideal accomplishment for someone. And I always thought Dan could do more. And so when I would get on him and I would get pretty hard on him, it was because I wanted him to do more because I expected more and I thought he could do a lot more. That's all.
Did he explain why he didn't appeal to him?
Yeah, because we talked about it, you know, and I he just said that this is what he wanted to do.
He wants to stay, you know, local.
He wanted to do radio and he wanted to do it local and he wanted to talk about his local teams and wanted to maintain that. You know, I always thought as radio was growing, you know, from the time I was there in 2001 and how it started to develop and grow, he could have done something nationally while being local. But he wanted to talk only about his local teams And I can totally understand that, the teams that he actually had a real passion for. And that's completely fair. So it was unfair for me to want more for him, but I always thought he could do a lot more.
One of my favorite things about Bernstein is he does not care if you go at him for his takes or to make him the butt of the joke or anything. And when I would listen to you guys, you would go at him hard. Do you have a favorite? Like, do you have a favorite on-air confrontation between you and Bernsey?
Well, it's funny that you asked that, Danny, because you guys actually played it. You know, in the opening there, Dan and I were arguing, and I can't remember what we were arguing about, but he literally reached for the hold button on the phone as we were arguing, because that's what he would do with listeners that got exceptionally stupid or just got out of control or out of hand in one way or another. Dan would put them on hold. And, you know, at that point, you're free to take body shots and there's no one stopping you. So as we're arguing, he actually reached for the hold button on the phone to stop me from talking. And that set me over the edge a little bit. And I did turn his mic off and turn the volume down. And I'm like, well, now what, man? You got nothing there. So that was probably my favorite episode, because to me, it was just like, what are you trying to do, man? You can't shut me up. I'm right here. You can't put me on hold. So that was pretty funny. It was funny to hear that come back, actually.
You have a temper from time to time. You ever almost lose it with him?
You know, well, thankfully, Dan, my temper is a little better under control in life now. But certainly during those times I did. I mean, I would, you know, I never got physical with Dan. I never came close to getting physical with Dan, in a bad way, just on the good ways. But there were times where I was screaming top of my lungs and just swearing at him left and right. Absolutely. I would lose my crap on him. It's happened before. Absolutely. But like ever to a point where it was physical, where I was driven to that type of anger. No, that only happened with one guy I worked with there. And it wasn't Dan.
Care to share?
Yeah, it was Murph. It was the day that Murph and I had the confrontation about the Mr. Coffee, the Mr. Coffee commercial.
Oh, the Joe DiMaggio commercial.
Yeah. So, yeah, Dan, I don't know if you know this story. I know you were a listener too, as well. But we used to play non-revenue generating spots during commercial breaks during Murph's show, because they were you know, quirky and funny, and you know, Joe DiMaggio, Pub, and Mr. Coffee. So we would extend our commercial breaks even longer by playing something that wasn't generating revenue because he thought it was cute. That doesn't sound sarcastic, does it? I'm being genuine. There were two different versions of the Mr. Coffee commercial, and they were like 7 seconds in difference. And I played the wrong one, and it led to a big confrontation. Eventually, that was a Monday, and it led to a confrontation on Thursday. He'd been stewing about it the whole week until he finally said something, and then I almost lost it. If Lawrence hadn't come running out of the studio and grabbed me, I would have. Like, at that moment, I was like, my career is ending. I'm fine. I'm going to get fired. And whatever happens is going to happen, because I'm going to punch this guy in the face.
God, that is awesome.
Yeah, dude, he was like extra special that week after that thing happened. And so finally by Thursday, it's like 3 in the morning or so, or 3:30, 4. And, you know, I was like, dude, what's going on with you this week? Like, there's something extra going on. And he's like, no, I'm fine. And I'm like, all right, like, now is your chance to get it off your chest. And he walks away and he comes back and he's like, you know, I will tell you what's bothering me, though. And I'm like, okay, that's great. And then he went on to tell me that I played the wrong commercial, and that 7 seconds threw off his whole day, which then threw off his entire week. And he's been having a bad week because of it. And at that point, when I realized he was being sincere and genuine and honest, I lost my absolute mind. Like, I couldn't believe this guy was talking about 7 seconds or something that happened 3 days earlier. It was, you know, looking back on it now, it's one of my great memories of being there. But honest to God, man, if Lawrence hadn't been there and seen what was going on and come out and grab me from outside the studio, I was going to lose my mind on him.
Do you miss it at all?
Hell yeah, I do. I absolutely miss it. You know, it was a great place to work. I mean, it certainly is a great job to have. You know, when you look back at almost 17 years of watching sports, talking about sports, going on different trips, being around different teams, meeting athletes and celebrities, and you know, just doing radio in general, is just a great, fun job. The industry has got its pitfalls and some, you know, black holes that I hate about it. But overall, man, I love the job. I was in my hometown talking about my hometown teams. I met some amazing people that I'm still super close friends with and will be the rest of my life because of that job. You know, you're forced into small spaces with people for, you know, several hours a day, you know, throughout the entire year, and you develop really good relationships with people. So I do absolutely miss it. And, you know, I think looking back, Danny, if I would have done things differently at the end of my time there than the way that I actually did them. So yeah, I certainly do miss it a lot.
Maddie, well, Maddie, I will think of you every time I punch the button on a U2 song. I think of you, given our shared indifference about that act of the 80s. So thank you for spending some time with us. It's good to hear from you. I'd love, when we get back to getting together, let's get together. All right.
No, I certainly want to. I want to have that dinner with you. And Danny, I always think of you when it comes to U2. I have some great fond memories. Our things that we did outside the station together, I'll never forget those, but inside radio experiences, and I'll always remember that. And Danny, I hope Owen's doing well, and I'm glad that everything worked out, and you guys are a happy, healthy family right now. I'm really happy for you. I can't be happier that you're a dad to a son, man. It's the greatest thing in the world.
Thank you. Yeah, it was very nice message you sent when all of that chaos was going down. I appreciated it, and I apologize for pocket dialing you because a Batacola is the first contact in my phone. So I probably pocket dial you like once every 6 months or so. So I apologize for that.
It's okay. It happens a lot. The biggest culprit of that always was the shoe mouse. David Schuster would butt dial me on a regular basis. So
David Schuster, go away.
Yeah, he would always call me. Yeah, you know, Dan, the advice I gave Danny was just don't F it up. I'm like, congratulations, don't F it up. So. Mm-hmm. I have full confidence he won't.
That makes one of us. Maddie, thank you.
Thanks, right, Maddie.
Thank you. Congratulations again to Dan Bernstein. I love him in a special way.
That is Matt Abaticola, longtime B&B producer. In all sincerity, 25 years at one radio station is an incredible accomplishment. The dude is wildly talented, so congratulations to Dan Bernstein.
I would say this, too, so we can give it some closure. I'm very close to our program director, Mitch Rosen, as you know. He shares a lot of his most intimate thoughts about the business, about his life with me. We're friends. Of all the guys who have hosted full-time shows at the Score, Dan Bernstein has been the lowest maintenance of all of us for the program director. He has been the easiest guy for Mitch Rosen to deal with.
And he was the nicest at the Score to me by far.
He's the only guy who reached out to you on the air.
There is not even a close second when I got the job.
Not even the guy you were partnered with reached.
Yeah,
out.
There is not even a close second in terms of the air staff. Bernstein has been great to me since I got the gig back in January of 2017. So I will always appreciate him for that. It's McNeil and Parkins on the Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.